So talk is really about Dharma and healing. Now we're talking, yesterday really we talked about sickness, and today I want to go explore more the real process of healing and the way the Dharma relates to it. And we really need to, again, get out of the shtanz, the tavnit of a symptom or a pain or a difficulty being unhealthy, and explore for us, each of us, where is healing for each of us? Where is the healing? And how does it happen for each of us? And it's a different question. I remember this old Jewish story about a rabbi who was a healer. And people would come to him, come into his room, knock on the door, and he would listen to them, he would stroke his beard, and he would give some words, and they would come and they would be cured. And so he became famous, and some doctors came, and they wanted to know what he does. So they came and they sat with him in the room, and people would come in and they would tell their problem, and he would stroke his beard, and they would go out happy, cured, apparently. And they said, we don't understand. Where is the healing? What heals? You listen to them, you do this, and then they go, and they you give a few words, and is it the words? He said, no, the healing happens when I stroke my beard. That's when the healing happens. So it's subtle. It's, again, healing is becoming whole. Curing is getting rid of. So, yes, we can cure. And at times we will say, I want to cure myself, and it's okay and all that, but we have to understand that that's not necessarily healing. Healing is being whole. And I have two quotations here, one which I like. One is from Stephen Levine. He says, if there is a single definition of healing, it is to enter with compassion and awareness those pains, both mental and physical, from which we have withdrawn in judgment and dismay. Dismay is slida or alarm or If there is a single definition of healing, it is to enter with compassion and awareness those pains, both mental and physical, from which we have withdrawn in judgment and dismay. And what happens when there's something that is unpleasant to us, from an amoeba, you know, all beings withdraw from discomfort. All beings withdraw from discomfort. An amoeba, if you put a little bit of salt, gargir melach, in the water, it goes. And we withdraw from what is uncomfortable. And this creates struggle. And struggle because we withdraw, protect, go away from, wanting to get rid of, wanting to stop. And then we call it disease. What is disease? In English, again, is dis-ease. Means the ease is ninachut. Dis-ease is in-inachut. In-inachut. Lo ha-lo ninoach. their definition of disease. So really disease is about not being at ease, meaning, again, being in struggle. So we need to give space to the things that are difficult for us to be. We need to give, to be open. We need to connect with those areas. We need to be in dialogue, as I said. And it's completely not about functioning. You can imagine being someone, a neche, well, they can't get up from the Kisei Gogolim ever in their life. But you see this person with bright eyes, shining eyes, beautiful person, completely okay, and you have to say this person is healthy. Because if you define health as function, then we're all hopelessly sick. Then better we, only those guys that doing running marathons, we can say are healthy. And we're all sick because we can't run a marathon. You can't define health as function. There's a nice story, it just reminds me. Rumi, some essays of Rumi that I read. In one of his essays, he said, someone came to a big professor and said, I think it was the other way around. A professor came to a sage, Ish Chacham, and said, what's health? And Ish Chacham said to this man, well, you tell me. Well, he said, oh, sure, I know what's health. It means to have red cheeks, and to be active, and to be vital, and to do your work, and to have energy. He said, no. Those are signs of health. Those are signs. Those are expressions, symptoms of health. So what is health? Oh, I can't say. I don't know. Because I only know signs. What's not signs? Man lo symptomim shel bryut. And so it's not about function, health. It cannot be. And that's not just in the language. You think, oh, it's just zerak ha-safa. It's lo safa, because we can feel, you know, totally healthy, and yet we can't do a million things. Or like me, I'm 70, getting 70, and my grey beard. I can't do a million things I used to do when I was 20, so is that it? And then we really have to have a different view of life. The Dharma would invite us to go deeper in this. What I said up to now is universal wisdom, basic wisdom. The Dharma would go deeper. The Dharma would say that the world is, as we experience it, is a broken world. Samsara is a conditioned state where we are all the time affected and controlled by conditions. Ill health, suffering, pain, the result of conditions. We can't avoid being affected by conditions. Conditions will, in the end, put us in the earth, kill us. We are entirely made by conditions. We are also born because of conditions. And we die because of conditions, and everything happening in between is also conditions. So what we need to do is to live with wholesome conditions. Our living experience should be wholesome. Wholesome means mazin. Wholesome means bidyuk mashe amarti kodem, healthy. Healthy in the deeper definition. Conditions that are whole, shalem. And then we become shalem because we're all the time with those conditions. We're all the time moving in that world. We're all the time living in the flow of relationship, living in the flow of peace, in the flow of wisdom, including the wisdom of non-control, of not being in control, knowing that we're not in control. That's also wisdom. That's also creating a different inner world, which is more in relationship with all the conditions that happen. The Buddha said, living in peace, free from emotional pains, loosening our grip on the self, this is the ultimate medicine for both mental and physical health. Living in peace, free from emotional afflictions or pains, loosening our grip on the self, is the ultimate medicine for both mental and physical health. And it goes much, much deeper than that, of course. It goes to a place where if you no longer are identified with the body, you no longer see your body as yours, but you see it as part of the universe. You no longer have ownership of your own body. And that's a deep place of practice. It's not my body. It's just a body. So there, then really dramatically changes the pains and the difficulties and the diseases. And the, it's not my body. It's just not my body. Identification with the body goes down. So it's not my body anymore. And then this pressure to heal, to be better, to do, to change it, to this goes away. And you just function like the story of the Buddha with the massage I gave yesterday. His friends and Ananda massaging his body. Oh, look, it's old. Oh, look, it's like this. Oh, look, it's like that. Oh, well, it's just a phenomenon. The body is a phenomenon. That's all it is. So in the deepest level, which really comes through deep practice, samadhi practice especially, and not only, but also samadhi, you know that you're not the body. The self is just not anymore interested in the body. So there is something very on a very deep level. But I want to go back a little bit from there and talk about ways which we can relate to, a little bit like I talked to you, Rachel, earlier, how we, this little dialogue we had, ways of being wise in relation to the unpleasant phenomena. And here I want to introduce this word sattva. Did I talk about it yesterday? No, it's an interest. It's just such a beautiful word from my point of view. Oh, and I remember I invited Gal, who's an Ayurvedic practitioner, to come and talk to us, and then I forgot. Maybe I can still phone him afterwards, and maybe he can pop in later. We'll see. So I'll tell you a story. When I was in India in 1976 for 1 year, I hung out with the sadhus, of course, And they talked to me about this principle of reality called sattva. And I won't go into the whole Indian, you know, the Indian view of the trigunas. Trigunas, there are three qualities. One is rajas, which is anything that is agitated, active, hot, busy, controlling, sick through diseases of sattva, of rajas, which are diseases of heat, of fire, of too much, of more, of you know, heart disease and these rajas. The Western world is a rajasic world, overactive, burning up. Like the planet is burning. We're burning the planet through rajas. Because we can't stop consuming, running, doing, burning. The opposite is tamas, which is low energy, dead energy, stuck, or the Chinese medicine would say stuck. Takua, no vitality, low energy, etc. And sattva is harmony. But not only harmony, but harmony in a very delicate way. Sattvic is also wisdom. Sattvic is the wisdom to be non-harming in the world. And it's very similar to the concept of kusala in the Buddhist world. Kusala, but it's more kusala is more spiritual, it's more dharma language. But sattva is more to do with lifestyle in the Indian philosophy. So sattvic is wisdom, is non-violence, is harmony, is health, is wholesome, and a refined, delicate. And I learned about this, and I heard from them that being a vegetarian is a sattvic way of life. That means it creates change in the mind, not only in the body, because mind and body are part of sattva. So that vegetarian, you're changing your diet to a diet that creates a more refined mind, a more wise mind, a more delicate mind, a more subtle mind, and a more non-violent mind. And this for me was the reason I became vegetarian, 76, and I've been like now it's 40 years that I haven't eaten any meat or chicken. I have had fish, yeah, but very, very rarely, but I have, yeah. I want to go, it's not relevant now. We can talk about it later, but... Yeah, but we can talk about it later, because it's, the point is not my story, the point is sattva. So I just think it's a good thing, and I invite you all just to look up sattva in Wikipedia. Just check the word, S-A-T-T-V-A. Maybe I'll get Gal to talk about this afternoon if I can find him, and he might pop in. S-A-T-T-V-A. So, what is it that can come, let's look and be a little practical, what are some things that can come from our Dharma practice that lead us to a better relationship with health? And very specific things. Well, the first one I want to talk about is the movement to non-fixing, to this natural tendency that we have to fix things, the taken, to make things more comfortable, le shaperat atzmi, le shaperat olam, le, you know, to make things better all the time. to fix myself and the world, which is about control. And it makes pressure. And the pressure on ourselves mostly is that the things should be different from what they are. And the movement, the opposite movement, is sadha in Pali, which is trust. Trust is we trust that things are the way they are. We don't trust that things are better. We trust things to be the way they are. We trust the world to be the way the world is. It's a very deep place, but it's one of the great spiritual powers. It's one of the things that really change our life and our practice. We trust the world to be the way it is.
Other than what?
The way it is.
Other than what?
Other than the way it is.
But we always want to fix it. So we are trying to make it other than what it is. To be with what it is a fundamental, it's close to surrender, like we talked about before. But it's inside surrender. You need the trust. That's why I think when Treya Wilbur was talking about surrender is a kind of taking charge, but in a different way, I think what she means and what's under it is the power of trust. Trust is a huge power. It is not passive. It is not giving up. It is not the Urim Udaim, nothing I can do. It makes change. Trust makes change, but it's trusting in the way things are. And from that place, we go out and meet the world. If we need to take a medicine, we will take a medicine, but we'll take it from trust and not from wanting to control the symptoms and the pressure that things have to be different, that I must fix it, I must fix it, it's urgent. My daughter, Yasmin, is a CBT practitioner, and she's in CLIL, and she receives, actually she was practicing in England as a counselling psychologist for some years, and she was working for the health system in England, like the Kupat Cholim, the National Health Service, and in England she would get a lot of clients who had health anxiety. In Israel, more, I think. In England, if anyone's got a health anxiety, they just go to a pub and take a beer. But in Israel, health anxiety is like a major social psychology. It's in the psyche of the social psychology in a way. It's a big thing. So she sees a lot of people here and there for health anxiety, which is exactly the opposite of trusting things to be the way they are and then going out and doing what you need to do, including taking a medicine. It's another place altogether. And it's the same with yourself. You are okay as you are. Now go out and live. That doesn't mean, and this is where the dialogue with you, Rachel, before. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't decide, now I'm leaning against the wall because my back is hurting. And now I'm not leaning against the wall because I actually want to experience this experience more deeply. It doesn't mean any of those. What you actually do is a whole other category. It comes from who you are in every moment and your relationship with the moment, how you relate to this moment of experience.
But is it also believing that things are as they should be? Like,
no.
There's no should.
Yeah, there's no should in it. Things
like
shouldn't...
I got it because karma made it like this.
Yeah.
I have to suffer this because this is the result of what I did.
No, that's not kusala.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not kusala. Mamashlo, zelo kusala, zelo harmony, and it's not trust. I know what I'm saying is challenging because there is a natural need for explanation. for the dogma. We need to feel comfortable, but when we look at that hasibatiyut, it's dachaf lasbir. Ani imani, you know, if the doctor comes and says, you have ulcerative colitis. Maze zemila belatini. In the old times, just the doctor coming and telling a word in Latin, the patient would go out like stroking the beard, feel better already. Lama, because it's od pan tlut. To if we yesh lanu sibatim, if we know, then we feel all right. So we need to be beyond this, beyond fixing, beyond labels, taviot, beyond pathology, beyond the need for esberim, sibatiyut, and all that. Reduce all that by trust and awareness. Reduce the stories, reduce the comments, reduce, I can only be okay if, im ze kacha, az kacha, im az, im az, im az. Reduce all of that. And then we are healthy. We're in relationship with what is. Another aspect is, which is really, we forget, is the support which is really coming from the holistic medicine world, is to always support the life force, the prana. And sometimes the symptoms are an expression of prana. The symptoms are the body telling us about itself and expressing its health through symptoms. Pain is a message to say, wake up, there's a problem. Therefore, pain is healthy. It's telling us, it's the body saying something. The body says something because it's alive. It's telling us, Nu, I need you to do something right now. So the body is healthy by telling us it's through symptoms. We don't like it, but it's a sign of health. A symptom can be a sign of health. So we need to trust the life force. A lot of the life force is supported through inner peace and inner quiet, through non-addiction, through non-abuse, through non-disturbance. We can have a more powerful life force. And here, I think, is one of the powers of meditation, to affect our basic health. That meditation brings us to a place where we can choose more wisely how to live. And it can guide us who we are, what is fitting for us. Meditation is a place where we can get messages on a deeper level. What is fitting for us in our life? Just like, I think that's what happened to me with the tzimchonut, the vegetarian. It seems right, it seems wise, and I think it's helped me to be healthy, to be vegetarian all these years. I mean, it also, personally, it's led me on all kinds of, I think now, and I look back on it, rather not so wise things, but a bit kitsoni. When I was, when I first came to Klil, for 15 years, I was growing wheat in the field down here. And for 2 years, I was taking stones out of the field, which I think was very wise. I think it was a great thing that I did, just to clean stones from the field, 2 years. After that, I grew wheat in the field for 15 years, and I would sow it by hand, and I wouldn't harvest by hand, but I would then get sacks of wheat, and every morning I would bake bread with my own wheat for 15 years, because I thought that was a very holistic lifestyle, and I was really attached to ecological living. So this is what I did, 15 years. I would grow wheat and grind it with a hand grinder, not use electricity, because it was so crazy ecology. Wouldn't use electricity. There was no electricity in the house. So I was grinding the wheat by hand and making bread every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. Amazing. Now I wouldn't do it. It was like extreme a bit. So, but it felt then right. Now I think I was a bit cuckoo. Yeah, it was fine, but it was a bit obsessed, you know. Obsessed, obsessive. But now, for example, one of the things I do that I think is a real amazing source of health for myself is growing my own food in the vegetable garden. And I do it religiously every year. I'm doing it, you know, every day I do something in the garden, putting seeds, making shtilim, planting, making compost, putting from the chicken compost from the chicken shit into the garden, making arugot, planting, weeding. I spend a lot of time on this. And I feel it has an effect on the body because of the activity and because of the good food and because organic and so on and so on. But it has a really important effect on the mind, which is I feel in the cycle of life. I give to the vegetables. Because of me, they are them, they are there. Because of them, I am there. So when I'm in the vegetable garden, I feel in an intimacy with something basically sattva, fundamentally harmonious, healthy. We give to each other. It's a beautiful thing. And then the food tastes beautiful and wonderful, and it feels very nutritious, and everything works. And somehow, and I can't, and in sibatiyut, and in ze, and in, you know, but we managed to have good food. So this is a life of Dharma in a way that leads you. What I'm saying is that the practice of Dharma leads you to lifestyles that create health. And so it really can affect physical health. The monks, for example, the Buddha said to the monks, don't eat after lunch, because this way you'll be healthy, you'll have energy, and you'll live a long time. And it supports vitality. So you have some hours in the day consuming, and the rest of the day cleaning. Some hours you put in, some hours, the rest of the day you just clean out. So it's kind of, from the Dharma. So I think that we are in a place there where we need to be aware of life force, chi, prana, vitality, and its healing power. And this, we can become more intimate with it through our meditation practice and our Dharma life. We can become more sensitive to the prana, to the life force in us. And then we will also be a bit kinder when the life force says, you have a virus.
There's something about that. If, for example, in relation to food, if you think something is healthy for you, you're saying, for example, whatever, milk or eggs, but at the same time, in terms of morality, you think it's not super healthy, then there is some kind of contradiction. That for me it's hard to balance between.
I think, firstly, there are no real recipe book that will tell you how to solve these problems. These dilemmas are with us all our life. We will never be able to, there's no one that can tell you exactly what you need to do. So they're not easy decisions to make. That's the first thing to understand. As we become more sensitive and aware, the decisions of this kind become more easy. So we need to ask, what tools am I using to be able to understand this problem? That's a more important question. What am I bringing to this problem? There isn't an easy answer. So what tools am I using to try and solve this? And clearly tools of awareness and sensitivity and of listening are the kind of tools we need that will then give us an answer. But it's a personal answer. For one person, it's more important not to eat eggs and milk because of the suffering of animals. It touches them more, and they have to go there. For another person, that's not the big issue, and something else is the issue, and they need to go there. What is important to understand is that the ethics is part of health. So that our ethical relationship is sattva, is part of our non-violence, and our relationship is part of health, or in the wider sense, is harmony, is sattva, is living with wisdom, so is also living with health. Therefore, morality has to be part of the picture. But how much weight you put there is really a very individual thing. I had a whole one-day workshop I was teaching in Beta Sangha on the whole issue of Tivonut. And were any of you there? I don't remember. But anyway, I taught one... זה היה יום, כן, יום מלא, איזה יום שישי, על הנושא של טבעונות. בכל מיני רבדים, כל מיני אספקטים וכל... והיה שם שניים, שלוש טבעונות, די טבעוניות, טבעונים. טבעונים.
נשים, אז זה
טבעוניות. סליחה, טבעונים. Vegans in English. שהם די... זה קצת... קיצוני, והם מתחיל קצת לתקוף אותי, למה אני אוהב חלב פרה בתי שלי.
בגלל אלה אין לנו גבינה באנדור, למשל.
אני יודע, וזה מתחיל...
יש חלב, אבל אין גבינה.
זה מתחיל איזה הרבה הרבה...
אין לה בנשק.
יש הרבה דיון שיצא מזה, אבל אני שאלתי, תגיד, מה אתה רוצה להגיד לדלאי למה שהוא אוכל בשר? אתה חושב שהוא בן אדם לא מוסרי? הוא עוזר לכל הפלנטה, הוא אין סוף של החמלה והאכפתיות לכל העולם, ואתה רוצה להגיד, אתה לא טוב בגלל אתה אוכל בשר. זה אומר שאנחנו לא יכולים להיות בגלל מי שאומר טבעונות, זה הדבר, אז, אבל לא משנה אם אתה עושה משהו אחר, אתה משתמש את האייפון הזה, ולא אכפת שהילדים קטנים בתאילנד או בווייטנאם סובלים 12 שעות כל יום כדי שיהיה לך אייפון, זה לא תחום שלי. טבעונות, הפרות זה... אי אפשר, אז צריך לבחור, צריך להבין, צריך להיות יותר ענווה, ואי אפשר בגלל הדפוס במוח שזה הדבר, תגיד לבן אדם אחר, אתה חייב להיות שם ולא שם. בן אדם שעוזר זקנים לדוגמה, אני אומר את זה כל הזמן שאנשים שאומרים, נגיד, למה אתה יושב בבית ולא לצאת demonstrations, לא, אבל בן אדם שכל החיים שלו הוא עוזר אחרים בתחום הזה, בתחום, אי אפשר להגיד לו שאתה צריך להיות בזה, לא בזה. So we have to choose where we want to be, and if we are, the main thing is to go back a little bit and say, what are the tools? Where is our heart? How big is our heart? How big is our wisdom? And then trust that life will come and tell us what to do. No, no, בוודאי לא.
וגם השאר ב...
כן. בוודאי. So I want to go into one other aspect of what I would say the Dharma can bring us. And this is something we talked about yesterday already, which is the whole issue of deep listening. Hakshava amuka. Hakshava amuka, deep listening. And the language of the body. And to understand that there are layers and layers and layers, שכבות ושכבות ושכבות, שהגוף, הגוף נפש, מספר לנו. So we really need to do some inner work here to understand the deeper layers of what the stories that the body mind is telling us, to listen to the voices, hakolot yoter adinot, because really in the deeper places there is where first of all we understand healing, and secondly we understand or we can reduce the pain and suffering, because at the deeper voices, the more subtle voices often tell us much more interesting things than kuevli, it hurts. They're much richer. And somehow this simple definition, lo naimli, disappears when we listen more deeply to pains and difficulties. This one track, this fixation is kibaon, this lo tovli va anipo va davar ze lo tovli koevli, this is very this is where the pain is really. The minute we are listening, the whole thing becomes so fluid, dynamic. The pain that comes and goes, and we can define it. Oh, now it's okay, but now it's not okay, but now it's less, now it's more, now I'm okay, now I forgot it. Now this, life is full. Yes, there's pain, but life is huge. Okay. This whole dynamic opens up through deep listening. There's an extraordinary article here that is written by this Zen teacher who also was very sick, like the other Zen teacher that I quoted who was sick. She's a different one. Joan Sutherland, she's called. It's in a book, so I can't send it to you, but it's so beautiful. How do I send it? So someone has to do it. I don't have Xerox machines, and you know, if someone wants to do it, they're welcome to do it. Yeah, you can make copies. Oh. All right, I'll give it to you. You can make a copy.
I thought you were saying I can't for moral reasons.
No.
Just for technical reasons.
Technical reasons.
Sorry. I don't want to scan. It's 20 pages. I don't want to do that. It's bad enough dealing with my computer with simple emails. But someone else can do it, maybe. Meditation, I'm going to quote one or two quotes from her. Meditation enabled me to watch what was happening unflinchingly, means without alarm, bli bahala, and over time to deeply accept it as the fact of my life. It means her pains, her disease. It helped me to build a psychic container, mechal, strong enough to hold experiences that would otherwise have overwhelmed me. It takes the strength of soul to absorb, to this fog, the losses of chronic illness, losses of relationship, work, the simple pleasures of a body that just works. Meditation strengthens the soul. And there is also an unexpected sweetness that comes when you include the hard stuff, an acceptance of all of myself that became much easier to also extend to others, and this acceptance. Though illness limited my ability to practice in the traditional sense, I eventually stopped trying to be part of a sangha, and 5 minutes of lying down meditation was as good as I could get some days. It also brought me quickly, surely, and repeatedly to a confrontation with the ultimate. We're all standing at the edge of a cliff of life and death all the time. And it's just that with chronic illness, you can never forget that you're there. In this mindful attention to my illness, though, and she expresses a problem here with her practice, I was also a little too ready to be okay with things as they were. Every practice has its shadow side, and I've come to see that this kind of Zen, at the least the way I held it, had an atmosphere of resignation. Resignation of Larima to Yadayim. There is something noble about doing a hard thing gracefully, but there's something equally noble about seeking transformation with a willingness to risk everything. And I want to read also something similar, written by another woman. Actually, this is more than one essay. One is from her. Actually, there's a few essays here from different people, I realize. Wait a minute, I'll just read the quotes and then... There is an essential mystery here. From the perspective of emptiness, living or dying doesn't matter. Sick or well doesn't matter. This is not indifference, adishut, but an affirmation that life shines everywhere equally, without distinction or preference. It's all holy. In the same moment, without separation, it does matter whether my head hurts or my energy is good today. This is also holy. Both are Buddha nature, empty Buddha, sick Buddha. Body of radiance, radiance is shining, zohar. Body of knots, kshareem. Body of radiant knots, shining, kshareem sheh zoharim. Just perfect, this sickness. Completely frustrating, this perfection. And at night, it all tumbles into sleep together. And I want to read to you something else. This another woman wrote about deep listening. Many years later, she was also a Zen teacher. I was leading a session, and I found myself in the situation of giving teachings and interviews during the day and feeling like I was dying of heart palpitations, sleeplessness, anxiety, and dizziness at night. During the day I functioned, and at night the hammering of my heart terrified me. Even when I realized I was enjoying the session and quite comfortable with my role, the night music continued. And I finally realized I was going to have to go into the palpitations with a kind and open awareness and not wish them away. I did this at night in bed when the symptom was strongest. I put my attention into my heart's pounding and said something like, "Welcome." When I did this and stayed with this, a connection was gradually made with my abdomen, my inside. My breathing became heavy and I started to cry. A voice that seemed very ancient gradually came up. It was deeply hidden. It really couldn't be understood. I had to listen so carefully. It felt like a cry of grief. I felt it as abandoned, that I had abandoned myself. Hearing its faint call confirmed something I had known about myself, but I had been unable to experience. I knew I had a pattern of closing down my most vulnerable feelings, and I seemed to have done it one more time. So this is about listening and about inquiry. And it needs samadhi. The meditation, the samadhi really means deep, silent awareness. It really means to go deep in meditation. I must say that many of you, you know, who know Yael, knew Yael Simcha, knew her qualities and how she found a deep joy and release as her disease got worse. She actually got better in herself. But what maybe you didn't know is the intensity of her meditation practice. And I was very involved with that. Good. Because I know that might put you off. It might make you feel, well, I can't do that. But somehow or other, we need to invest in another way of doing things. Otherwise, life will be on our backs. And we really, we really need to take our practice more seriously. We can't really go to the level of deep listening that this needs without investing in it, without really investing. And the final word, that presence, like the started off with the rabbi healed because of presence. Nochochot. Stroke his beard and something happened.
And
yeah, magic is presence. It's their magic is about presence. But presence without conditions. One thing, you know, what she wrote also, presence, it doesn't have preferences, without conditions, just presence. Often you know that. If you go to a therapist, sometimes the therapist, you know that the therapist is healing because of presence. Maybe the therapist doesn't know himself or herself that it's happening. It's not always in the conscious mind at all. But sometimes a therapist can heal you, or you can heal yourself through presence. Nochut. Just something that is a mashader in the moment, not conscious at all. So presence is something that we need in our life. It will heal us. As much as we are listening, we're also present with ourselves, present with our difficulty, present with our life. That itself is healing. And it's close to compassion. And compassion and presence go together. And they both heal. And it's in the word bodhisattva, of course. Sattva is the same word. Sattva, that I used before. Bodhi is consciousness. Sattva is harmony. And bodhisattva is the embodiment of compassion. So we'll stop there and we'll have just a moment of silence. Mm.